Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gif. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sports book. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain. And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. And kids, follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
Plus, you can always listen to all of our episodes, old and new, on the Broadway Podcast Network, iTunes, and Spotify.
If you love musical theater as much as we do, then without a doubt, one, if not all, of this author's many books sits on your shelf. Each one of them is a beautiful gem and an indispensable addition to any theater geek's collection, mine included as well.
His many books include The Oxford Companion to the American Musical, Musicals and Film, The Tin Pan Alley Encyclopedia, The Jerome Kern Encyclopedia, The Disney Song Encyclopedia, Off-Broadway Musicals since 1919, Word Crazy, Broadway Lyricists from Cohan to Sondheim, American Plays and Musicals on Screen, and countless, countless many more.
And quite exciting to us, his newest book, The Mikado to Matilda, British Musicals on the New York Stage, is now available for reading. We have read it. It is fantastic. It is fantastic. And having just finished it, I can say it is the definitive book on West End musicals. To discuss his authorship, his hobbies, and his craft, here is Professor Thomas S. Hischek. Thomas, how are you?
Great today.
Thomas, where exactly do you hold academic appointments?
I was 33 years at the State University of New York in Cortland, New York. Retired, came down to St. Augustine, Florida, where we love it, my wife and I. And I teach part-time now at Flagler College. I teach film and theater.
All right, Thomas, where did this love of theater come from?
Growing up in the Midwest, I didn't see a Broadway show until I was 20 years old.
Oh.
So I grew up listening to cast albums.
Mm-hmm.
Amateur productions, and by high school, seeing some tours that came through Dayton, Ohio. And Dayton, Ohio was not, you know, one of the great hotspots for, you know, first class tours. So I came late into theater. I did not grow up in theater. You know, I wasn't the kid that was seeing children's theater. I wasn't like children today going to see The Lion King at the age of six. You know, and seeing Broadway theater. No. My first Broadway show was not until 1970 with Company, the original, And I was spoiled for life
because
I thought all shows would be that good.
What an introduction. What an introduction.
Yeah, it was a great introduction. I mean, I knew a lot of shows. I knew all the, you know, the Rodgers and Hammerstein, but to sit in a theater and see Company, I thought, wow. Yeah. And for the 70s, which is considered a pretty low point for a theater in New York, you know, number of shows, the 70s was a great period for me. That's the period of Sondheim, Kander and Ebb, you know, Evita. I mean, it was a great time for musical theater. But if you look at the history of musicals, it was a low point for a number of shows, attendance, New York City, Times Square, really bad time. But I really believe that most people who love musicals, your favorite musicals are the ones you saw when you were in your 20s.
Yeah.
They always hold a hot, it's such a special spot for you. And those are the ones that I most admire and still love.
Absolutely. So, Thomas, I have to ask, you know, you were playing all these original cast recordings when you were growing up. Which record do you think got worn out the most?
Oh, gosh.
From your continuous play.
I remember my mother had to buy Sound of Music and Camelot because we wore them out.
Yep. You know,
listening to them too much. These are the classics that... Music Man was in there too. I think the Music Man was not playable. But
that's understandable. Now, you said, did you grow up in Dayton, Ohio, or near Dayton, Ohio?
I grew up in Rochester, New York. Then we moved to Dayton, Ohio. So I seem to get further and further away. Then I went to school in St. Louis. Now you're really far from New York. And when I got married, my wife and I, we lived in Illinois, and for us to go to New York was a big deal, you know, to take a bus or we didn't drive it. We took a bus and stayed for a week, you know, and we're seeing shows in the early 70s, mid 70s.
Yeah.
We saw a lot of theater considering how far we were away. Mm-hmm. I am always jealous of those people who lived and saw every show.
Sure.
You know? Every cast album, every, you know, there wasn't, even if it was Walking Happy and it was the 99-cent, you know, L bin in Kmart, I got it. You know,
absolutely.
You're in good company.
yes, Thomas.
I was not too discriminant. I mean, I could tell good and bad, but I didn't hesitate. You got a cast album back when, you know, they were the LPs.
Right.
I mean, I think we're all, you're preaching to the choir. I think we're all the same way. Just grab it. And it doesn't matter if it's good, just grab it. You know, growing up, when you were in Ohio, did you see any of the Kenley Player shows?
Yes. I was in high school and then I went to college. So I can't say I think I was there for 2 summers and saw just about everything they did. And recently someone sent me an article about the Kenley Players, and that was an outstanding summer theater. And talk about being spoiled for life. That was the first summer theater I ever saw, was the Kenley Players. I thought all summer theater was that good.
Oh.
And it wasn't. I mean, the Kenley Players, John Kenley got good people, cast them the right way. And I got to see shows that you never got to see again. I got to see, you know, the Happy Time. Nobody did that. I got to see Half a Sixpence. I got to see all these shows that he just found the right person and he did them, you know, and besides the big hits too, you know.
Yeah.
So I treasure those probably 20 or 30 Kenley Player productions that I've seen. Yeah.
That's incredible.
He did 12 a summer, 10 or 12 summer.
Yeah. And they bring in like the movie star or someone or TV star to come in and.
Right, but you know what? They all had stage experience.
Of course, yeah.
I go to see Finian's Rainbow with Barbara Eden. The woman has unbelievable stage credits. She's brilliant.
Did you harbor any interest ever to get on stage yourself?
No, I did plays in high school, did plays in college, and I realized, by the end of college, I realized my interest was in directing, writing, playwriting. And so when I went to graduate school, I did not major in acting. I majored in playwriting.
And where was graduate school for you, Thomas?
Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. Got school it. For playwriting. Mm-hmm. And I knew I would make a living at playwriting, but I would teaching and directing. And that's when I started writing nonfiction, you know, about theater. First book was in 1990. And, you know, in 1990, there weren't a hell of a lot of books. You had your old classics by Stanley Green. And, you know, and there were just a handful of them. There weren't a lot of people writing yet. And I was lucky to write a book about lyrics because hardly anybody had ever written about lyricists. Now there's a lot of people writing and a lot of good people. Mm-hmm. And so I really had to find a niche to find, you know, what hasn't been written about. But back then, there weren't a lot of musical theater books.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think in that era there weren't really anything beyond what Stanley Green was doing?
I think more people take it seriously. More people are studying musical theater. Mm. I think there are college classes in musical theater that are not at NYU. You know, I started teaching musical theater in a state college, you know, as a seminar. And more people are going to the theater, musical theater, than in 1990, mm-hmm. younger people. So there's more interest in, you know, there's a lot of fluff books, a lot of great coffee table books, but there's a lot of books about musical theater every time you turn around. And I worry that when I write a book that somebody's not writing the same book because
sure.
there's a lot of people out there.
Yeah.
And you said, what was the name of the first book that you wrote in 1990?
Broadway Lyricist, Cohan to Sondheim.
And what inspired you to put this all down in a book?
I couldn't find a good book about lyricists. I did find later there was one. He quoted a lot of lyrics. It was by, I'm blanking out. And it was a great book for quotations. He quoted a lot of lyrics. But I wanted to look at every major lyricist, talk about their work, and quote from them, which was very hard to do back then. You had to pay. And it just was different enough that a publisher picked it up, and it did pretty well. Mm. But I thought the composers had been well covered, you know,
sure.
a lot of books about the composers. But I thought of these, you know, unsung heroes, although everybody sings their words. And then later on, the other one I really wanted to hit was the people who wrote the books. Talk about people overlooked.
Yeah.
And so that came a little bit later.
So Thomas, who do you think in the annals of lyricist history is a lyricist that does not get the credit that you think they deserve?
E.Y. Harburg.
Mm.
I mean, he is amazing lyricist, mm-hmm. but he doesn't come off the tongue as fast as when people say Sondheim,
right.
Lorenz Hart, you know, Ira Gershwin. Absolute brilliant lyricist.
And for our listeners, can you help remind us what were some of Yip Harburg's songs?
Everybody knows his work because they know Wizard of Oz, and he can write something as beautiful as, you know, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, but he can write really edgy stuff. For example, Finian's Rainbow, one of his few Broadway hits. He didn't have a lot of hits because his stuff was too edgy and too demanding. But he can write something as beautiful as How Are Things in Glacamora, and then he can write something as risque as When the Idle Rich Become the Idle Poor, talking about, you know, how we treat people depending on who they are. Wealth-wise, and he can write something about the atom bomb in Jamaica, a lyric about, you know, mm-hmm. The monkey in the mango tree making fun of evolution. So, yeah, he was always a little difficult. They were afraid to use him a lot. They were afraid what he was going to put in his lyrics. Bloomer Girl, for example, does anymore.
Love it.
Unbelievable. Great lyrics, but my goodness, you've got women's suffrage, you've got abolitionists, you've got all this stuff in it. And that's 1944, I believe. Mm-hmm. Brilliant lyricist. He sometimes wrote the book too, but it's the lyrics that make him, I would say if somebody's not given enough credit, he would be there.
That's great. And then, you know, your book on librettists is called Boy Loses Girl, correct?
Right.
And was that immediately following?
No. There's a couple other books in between, but I just, at one point I said, you know, every time I wrote about these shows and I keep seeing these names come up, you know, I said, oh, he wrote the book. Oh, he wrote the book for that one. Oh, he wrote the book for that one. And it was like, nobody knows who that person is, you know. And it's like, wow, you know, like this, some of these people wrote a lot of these books.
Yeah.
You know, so there you have Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hart. But, you know, but what who wrote the books for all those shows, you know? So some of the lyricists were book writers like Oscar Hammerstein. Right. So that was easy. But I was looking for the people who just never really got the credit. And I enjoyed doing that book a lot.
I was going to say that's such a challenging thing to do because I'm assuming, you know, everyone has access to listen to a cast recording. So you can hear the work, but what goes into making a good book of a musical?
Well, it's usually the start of what makes the musical successful. You know, somebody comes up with the idea, but it's the person who writes the book that it's pretty much... maybe it's not as true today, but it was true in the old days, that the book made or broke the musical. Remember, Sondheim was asked, what comes first, music or lyrics? Remember his answer?
The book.
Yeah. Don't talk about the songs. No. Get the book. Yeah. Then you can talk about songs. And even before Oklahoma, when, you know, the books were more integrated and more serious and more made more logical sense, even those... In those 30s, the book had to hold together. And that's why we don't do a musical, you know, like Peggy Ann, but right. We do Anything Goes, because Anything Goes has a pretty good book.
Yeah.
But we don't do Too Many Girls because it just doesn't have a good book, you know. But it has a great score.
Right.
So what do? We record all the Rodgers and Hart songs, but we don't do their shows. That's kind of the reality of it. Mm-hmm. And that happens with a lot of wonderful, you know, Cole Porter. Yeah, we do Kiss Me, Kate, you know, that's great. But what about all those shows that he wrote?
Let's face it.
Yeah. You know, well, we do Anything Goes and Kiss Me, Kate. But, you know, nobody's going to do 50, yeah. 50 million Frenchmen, because the minute they look at all those great songs and then they go, oh my goodness, look at this story. I put a lot of credit on the book. Today, the book writer, it's even harder because people expect so much more. They expect more than jokes. They expect the songs to fit into the story. They expect some logic. There's a lot of bad books, you know, musicals.
Sure.
And some weak books are disguised by wonderful productions, you know, great, beautiful productions. And, you know, I don't want to trash any new musicals, but it's like the production is so good that you go, oh, that really wasn't a very good book, but they disguised it. I think that happens on occasion, yeah.
You know, I feel a lot of times when people talk about the great books of musicals, it's always, they mention it's Gypsy and 1776 and A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. But in more recent times, Thomas, are there any books that you feel do an exemplary job of being mentioned in the same category as those other three shows?
Well, I have to avoid all the shows that are sung through, and there's some really good shows like Hadestown.
Yep.
There isn't a book. There is, but it's all sung, and that being a work by one person, you know,
yeah.
How do you separate the book from the lyrics and the music? I would say, for example, Craig Lucas's book for The Light in the Piazza.
Marvelous.
That is a book. It's based on a movie, based on a book, but a novel. But that is a solid book, a really solid book. And it's, the score is gorgeous. The production is wonderful. But the book is really important in that one. Other ones that I've been impressed with. I was very impressed with the book for Grey Gardens. A lot of people didn't like the show. But here's a documentary movie with no plot. and Jeffrey Thatcher. Oh God, I'm going to get the wrong book writer. But anyway, whoever took the book looked at that movie and said, how could we make a two-act musical out of this very odd documentary? And I thought it was excellent, you know, going in the past and then coming to the present, well, 1977. To me, that was a superb book. And even Wicked, I read the novel Wicked when I heard they were making a musical. And I said, this has got to be the stupidest idea since Bring Back Birdie. And I read it, you know, and I just said, I was fascinated by the book. And, well, you know, when the second lead or the third lead is a woman with no arms, I said, this really is not going to work. And when I went to see the show, I thought there were problems with the book, but I thought, I got to give this woman credit. She took this unbelievably complicated, convoluted, long epic and turned it into a pretty workable book. And I said, I think a lot of the success of Wicked is that book. You know, yeah, you can just do the magic and the, you know, and the big soaring numbers for so long. So not a perfect book, but it works. And I credit her.
Yeah, Winnie Holzman, right, who did the book on that. And just incredible job. When it comes to your research, I mean, you've written so many encyclopedias, right? You know, the Off-Broadway Encyclopedia, Rodgers and Hammerstein Encyclopedia. How do you do your research?
The facts are easy to find. It's what was the plot? That is not so easy to find. And even the internet hasn't helped.
Mm.
Really have to dig if you want to find the plot for a 1927 musical by Jerome Kern. Let's say. There you really have to go. You got to look at reviews. You got to look at people you trust, like Gerald Boardman, who was an expert in the old stuff and an expert in Kern, and to try to figure out what's going on. There are no cast albums until Oklahoma, so you got a problem there. You can say, oh yeah, the score was this, had this song and this song, this song, but who's recorded them? They never really recorded the whole show. They just picked the two or three shows, songs that were most interesting. So it's a little detective work, but I kind of like it.
Yeah.
The newer stuff, you know, even if they don't publish the book, you can find so many scenes. You can listen to the score. And for Off-Broadway, I did a whole book just on Off-Broadway musicals, and they aren't published. But the reviews are all there, and I can find out a lot if I didn't see it. And I don't see everything because I don't live in New York. But I can find out about an Off-Broadway musical, and maybe it wasn't a huge success, and I mean, it was a limited run at Playwrights Horizons, and it, you know, and it maybe it got a cast recording, maybe it didn't. But if I hunt in search, I could find it. Some on the internet, but mostly reviews, and if it's old enough, what people have written about it. But I tend to, if I'm doing a book, I get to the modern period, and it's not written about yet. You know,
there's not too
many books written about Hadestown, let's put it that way. You know, it's just too new, but a lot of it's written about it online. Yeah.
In addition to yourself, who are some of your other favorite theater writers or theater historians that, you know, that you find yourself gravitating towards in your research?
I was lucky to kind of become a protege to Gerald Boardman.
Can you tell us more about him, please? Because I think it's one of the first times we're talking about him on this show.
Yeah.
Gerald Boardman was a businessman. He went to very good schools, and he inherited the family business making mothballs. University of Pennsylvania, trained in the classics, but he had to sell mothballs. His family would go to England every year, so he saw all the shows in London. He lived in Philadelphia, saw all the shows in Philadelphia before they went to New York. He loved the theater. He gets about to the age of 40, and he realizes he's sick of mothballs. sells the family business and says, I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life to writing about the musical theater. And that's what he did. His very first book, he spent 10 years researching and writing a biography and a critique of Jerome Kern. And then he just started writing book after book after book. I met him because I wrote a book about songs, the American Musical Theater Song Encyclopedia. And the editor said, you want somebody to write a foreword? And I said, oh, Joy Earl Boardman. I don't know him personally, but send it to him. He wrote back and said, how old are you? At the time, I was like 30-something or whatever.
Right.
And he said, oh, well, that explains it. And then he started pointing out all the mistakes and all the this and all that. But we eventually met, and he got me some gigs. You know, he'd say, oh, I don't want to write the new version of this, you know, the Oxford this. And would you like to take over, you know?
Oh, wow.
He was a bit of a grumpy guy, and I couldn't believe it. He said to me at one point, I don't go to the theater anymore. I just don't like the new musicals. I can't stand anything that's mic'd, and I just stopped going. And I said, but you're missing some really good stuff. He said, I don't care if I'm missing some good stuff. I just don't. And it's funny, you know, 30 years later, I'm like, I don't mind miking. It's not my favorite, but there are days when I look at the lineup on Broadway and I'm going, I just really don't think I'm missing anything. but there's that show every season or every two, there's that show that says, oh no, don't give up. You know, no, there's still great stuff, you know, but I can understand how we got fed up. So he continued writing until the day he died. And he always took the point of view of the tired businessman. He says, I was the tired businessman who went to the theater in the old saw about, you know, oh, I'm do shows for the tired businessman, you know, different girls and everything. And he loved the serious stuff. But he said, I was that tired businessman who went to the theater and I loved it. And he absolutely loved the theater. But by the 1960s, he was losing interest, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was that early. Yeah. In the 70s, he was, you know, he kept going.
His area of expertise, I'm assuming, was what, like the early 20th century and
1920s was the...
That tome, yes, the chronology of American music. Right. I mean, that is my go-to sort of encyclopedia. Yeah. I mean, the number of words he wrote in that alone is exhaustive. Unbelievable is right. And it goes back to the 1800s.
Right. And one of the editions, he went backwards and included more. The very recent edition, Richard Norton has updated it, because he really hadn't seen any of the newer shows. And he wrote about some of them, but without having seen them and didn't know. And he was getting a little inaccurate. Mm-hmm. So I know Richard Norton, when he took over, he had to rewrite some of the last part of the previous edition. Mm-hmm. So it's still the best book one volume book to have so much information.
Yeah.
Now that book was of very little use to me when I wrote the book about British musicals, because that was about Broadway America. And anytime a British musical came along, whether it was Cats or whatever, they gave it a little paragraph, you know?
Yeah. He skipped right over that. Yeah. He didn't want to. Yeah.
And I was so disappointed. I thought, oh, let's see what Joe Boardman had to say about this. And it was like, oh my goodness. He goes, oh, this came for a week. And it was, you know, and it was like, oh, thanks.
Yeah.
And so in that case, I go to what I consider the second most knowledgeable person. And he's not as well known in this country. His name is Kurt Gansel. G-A-N-Z-L.
Oh, I love his
book. Yep. Yeah.
From Australia, New Zealand. Well, at least he lives in New Zealand. I don't know where he came from. He lived in England and in New Zealand. He is the expert on European musicals, not only British, but operettas France and Austria and whatever. He's multilingual. And he was the one that, without him, I couldn't have done the the London musicals, because he covers the London stage just like Joe Boardman did in his book. Gansel does for the London stage. He's also written about Broadway and other things. And he's a little bit younger than Boardman. He's still alive and still working on things. Lives in New Zealand, and I hear from him once in a while. But I did dedicate the British book to him because I don't know where I would have found out, you know, who was in the cast of, you know, the 1904 production of, you know, this particular British musical.
Yeah.
And interestingly, in England, they do not have anything like the best plays of, you know, the great series that
we developed
until 2007 is the last issue. They don't have that. You know, they do not have, like, we have the Internet Broadway database. There is no such thing in England. They tried, they started it, and it just fell through. It's too, you go too far back. It's too huge.
Yeah.
And nobody keeps, and it's, they don't have the resources. And so to this day, if you try to find out how many performances a London musical that played in 1974, you cannot find out how many performances. There is no record. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You look up in a book and they'll say it ran 2.5 months because they found it in a newspaper or something.
Huh.
So they don't have those giant things that I consider the Bible, you know, for facts. But Kirk Gansel, he wrote plots and opinions and songs and amazing stuff. Other people in America, I admire. He's so opinionated, but he's fun to read. Is Ethan Mordden?
Yeah,
yes.
One of those people you don't even have to agree; you just enjoy reading him. You know, he's very, very good. Stephen Susskind is very good, and he wrote one book. I still don't know how he wrote it. He wrote a whole book about the people who did the orchestrations for
and
Broadway.
The writers, yeah,
yeah.
Unreal.
I don't know how he wrote that book. I mean, he was going through scores, looking at handwriting to try to figure
out. It was actually orchestrated, but
the pencil writing, I think it was so, how he did that.
I know.
His books are impressive, but I told him once, that's a book that just boggles my mind, is, mm-hmm. and talk about an area that was never covered before. So there's several people, good people writing.
And
those are people writing books. Who knows? A number of people are just not writing books, but they have blogs. That's just, goes unbelievable. The number of people have blogs and columns and stuff. Right.
It's very exciting because we're also seeing, I think, a lot of younger people getting into the art of, you know, trying to preserve the history as well, which is really exciting. I mean, not only on blogs, but like if you look on Instagram as well or Facebook, they have whole groups set up, and it's just
right.
It's nice to see that the love for the theater is being passed on to a new generation.
Yeah, I'm not into all the social media too much, but with a little bit, like I have a Twitter account, but I'm not allowed to look at it because I'm just. Don't get it. But Mark Robinson, who you know from his blog,
yes.
He opened it for me and he says, I'll send the tweets out, but don't look at it.
He's one of my Twitter friends.
Well, I looked at it once and I was like, oh my God, there's too much stuff on here and there's too many crazy people and whatnot.
Yes.
But anyway, the little bit I have seen on Facebook, I don't even have Facebook, but not all of it's gossip. Some of it is seriously people have opinions and sometimes opinions that are not crazy, they're well-educated thoughts that they exchange about old musicals, new musicals.
You know?
So there's a dialogue going on that never existed in the old days, except for a bunch of people at a party talking.
Yes.
About them. Yeah. So it is very different.
Yeah, it is. It's a whole new world, Golda. It's a whole new world, Golda.
Hello, This is Audrey Hepburn. Welcome to Crackertown Dinner Theater and Grill.
Audrey Hepburn, this is Ann Miller here, and I'm disgusted. What are you doing in a place like this?
It's all I could get. I didn't know about Patreon.com. I didn't know you could go there to set up a monthly donation to keep going.
Well, the boys at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's living legends, like me, they know, and their listeners do too. They go there and set up a donation, and they donate all they can.
Oh, Patreon, it's wonderful, but will you be having the prime rib or the chicken?
I'll be having Patreon.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Okay, so I'm curious, before we start talking about this amazing recent book that you've created about British musicals that have come to New York City, as a researcher and as a historian, have you ever had a eureka moment or a moment of, in the middle of your research, you know, a light bulb went off and said, oh my gosh, I've never realized this, or wow, I've discovered something that people thought were lost?
Since I don't go through the archives of the Lincoln Center library, you know, I'm not going down to the original, you know, manuscripts. Sure. I've never discovered that, you know, that, I find things that I didn't know, and I'm so surprised because I've been wrong my whole life, and everybody had been wrong and been telling me things. And I don't know if it's a eureka moment, but it's like, oh my goodness, how can I do that?
Yeah.
On this recent book, I, along with everyone else, assumed Julie Andrews isn't the boyfriend, right? Everybody knows that. From the stage version, made her a star. I assumed she did it in London. Of course, she did it in London, then they brought her over. She didn't do it in London.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, everybody assumes she was the London girl they brought over. It was played by a very well-known actress in London, and she wasn't in it. And when they brought it to America, here was this young girl who had been singing her heart out since she was six with that gorgeous voice. She had appeared in a pantomime or two. She had no acting experience, but they said, we need somebody British. And so they brought her over for the Broadway version. She was horrible. She couldn't act. They were going to get rid of her. And finally somebody said, no, I think we could, you know, now we're talking the boyfriend here, Polly, one of the deepest characters ever written, right? and the director, I think it was the British director, said, no, come on. And they really were close to getting rid of her. And she opened on Broadway, and it wasn't a My Fair Lady kind of fame, but she got everyone's attention. And she really became, you know, like, wow, look at this girl. Listen to her. She's so charming. And, of course, Lerner and Lowe star, and there was no question. And Richard Rodgers wanted her pipe dream, good part.
Yeah.
And she says, I don't know what to do. And she said to Richard Rodgers, that Lerner and Lowe are doing this show based on Pygmalion. And he said, you should do that. I think that would be a better part. And it's funny because Rodgers and Hammerstein had tried to do Pygmalion and they gave up on it. They thought it was an impossible thing. And he said, no, do that. I think that'd be better for your career. And he never forgot her, did her, wrote Cinderella for her in mind. And then later on, she did the movie. So the connection with Rogers was pretty strong. But yeah. For me to find out she had never done it in London, I thought we were bringing over a London star here. You know?
So there's,
luckily, Stephen Susskind is the one who pointed out to me about Julie Andrews. He saw the final proof. And they sent it to him to write a little blurb.
Yeah.
And he said, of course, you're going to fix the Julie Andrews thing. And I said, what? And he said, she didn't do it in London. And I was like, oh, my gosh. And I looked immediately. And it's a terrible kind of research where I know that already. Uh-uh. You make sure, you know. And I looked in the original London cast. She's not there. And
I did not know that. My mind is blown on both of those fronts.
And it goes back to there's no database. There's no place with all of that information.
No, I had to go back to Gansel's cast, original cast.
Yeah.
And say, and she wasn't even a replacement. She wasn't even an understudy. She was singing in some concert hall. The girl was singing at the age of 6 or 5. It was unbelievable. And I even read her autobiography in it. I didn't catch on, you know, but so you learn.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you are amongst a small group of theater historians, you know, it's because it's not a large group. It's, you know, you, it's Ethan, it's Mark, it's Peter Felicia, Stephen Susskind, the great Ken Mandelbaum. You know, do you guys all rely on each other as a tight unit? Or I'm assuming there's no competition because you're all writing about things you love.
I've never met any of them. I've talked to Gerald Boardman.
Yeah.
I email Stephen Susskind because we've overlapped on some projects. I had a question for him, or he once had a question for me about a publisher, and he's written some blurbs. I have never met Richard Norton. He took over for Boardman. I think I know Richard Norton did look at one of my books because Boardman asked him to proof it. I have never met any of the other ones. I'm not in New York. If I lived in New York, I could imagine, you know, where sit in some bar and argue about, you know, if Ethel Merman could act or not.
I will say that's one reason why I never want to leave the city. One of my favorite memories of the city was I was in Westway Diner once by myself, and I heard a heated argument next to me, and it was two men yelling, "You don't know what you're talking about. You're so wrong." And the other guy said, "I'm right. You're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about. F you. I'm out of here." The guy left, and the other guy said, "He goes, I don't care what he says. Dorothy Collins was the best Sally I ever saw." And I said,
those are fighting words. Yes.
I said, that's the world I want to live in. So let's talk. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, example of that is Mark put a tweet of mine where I talked about Annie Get Your Gun in good old, oh my goodness, I'm blanking out. In the movie of Annie Get Your Gun, Betty Hutton. Betty Hutton. And said, I watched Calamity Jane again. And I, you know, which is a ripoff of Annie Get Your Gun. And how good Doris Day was. And I just tweaked and said, boy, Doris Day was pretty good as a sharpshooter, you know. And boy, did we get things saying. Doris Day should have played Annie Get Your Gun. You know, she would have been great as Annie Oakley. You know, it's like, why did they use her? You know, and you can see people getting hot under the collar about that. Because some people absolutely hate Betty Hutton, you know. And,
I liked her.
It's still going on. Those kind of arguments, yeah.
It's fun. Now, okay, so let's talk about this. This book is absolutely incredible. And once again, listeners, it's called The Mikado to Matilda, British Musicals on the New York Stage. So, Thomas, what was the inspiration for writing this all down?
There's a very good book came out several years ago by Adrian Wright. It's British critic, writer. He called it West End Broadway, The Golden Age of the American Musical in London. And I thought, what a fascinating book. And he talked about all the Broadway hits, American Broadway hits, that went to London and what happened to them. And I was very surprised to see that some even went over. I can't imagine they thought Fiorello would be a big hit in London.
Oh, wow.
I know. Nobody, you know, just like today, nobody knows Fiorello. They did in America at the time. And I was surprised to see what survived and what did very well. I thought, what a fascinating book. That got me started. What about the opposite? Mm-hmm. What about the London shows that came to New York and what happened to them? And I would only bring London shows that were successful. Mm. All right. So that was limiting it. I didn't know how far back to go. And but I thought, I can't ignore Gilbert and Sullivan because they were the most successful shows. And then I thought, well, I'll pick up a couple from the 1800s. And then I'll go right up through the British invasion. And I have this terrible weakness for alliteration. So I like the Mikado to Matilda, but I go back further than the Mikado and I go a little bit past Matilda. We got in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and School of Rock, I think, after that. So that's the inspiration is, yeah, let's look at these British musicals. Some are very, very famous, obviously, but what, you know, the ones that are not so famous and ones that ran quite a while in London and for some reason Americans just didn't, you know. Sometimes it wasn't the critics, it was the audiences. Sometimes it was the times, all different reasons. And that's what interested me. I said, that's what I want to research. And there I'd be talking about a lot of musicals in the past that I knew nothing about. And I'd be talking about Broadway's version of Jerome Kern, you know, in the old days, you know, the Jerome Kern. The Cole Porters and of the 1910s and 20s. We all knew Noel Coward, you know, we knew some of the biggies, but who were their big, you know, writers and composers who had hit after hit after hit? And some of them came over here. So that's what got me interested. And because of the books, it's a 3-volume set and other books by Gansel, I knew I could find out about these musicals.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, I was able to listen to a lot of them on YouTube. Yeah. You have to remember the British were way ahead of us when it came to recording Broadway, musical theater.
Yeah.
You know, Oklahoma's our first original cast album. The British were recording songs from musicals in the 1890s, not a whole cast, but just a song or two.
Wow.
Yeah.
And by the 20s, they are doing full cast recordings. Not like we think of today with every single song, but on 78s, probably about 3 or 4 78s, which would give you about 8 songs, you know, because 78 would run it long.
Yeah.
You can listen to the entire cast of No, No, Nanette, the British cast. On 78s, they were selling them. And that's 1920, you know, 4 or whatever. They just did it. And so we have, for American, not to mention British, we have recordings. So I was able to hear a lot of stuff. And also, we are impressed by numbers of performances. You know, so we say, oh, Oklahoma broke the record and it ran this many performances. Well, the British had shows that ran over 1,000 performances by the turn of the century. The theaters were smaller, and they just ran and ran and ran. And numbers that we never had. Doesn't mean they were better, no, but long runs were, you know.
Yeah,
I think some of it is a lot of American shows closed in the summer because it was too hot. And then they'd reopen. But the British summers are not as hot, and most of their shows just ran through the summer. So they had the momentum, and they kept playing, and then it would, you know, business would go down a little bit. And we had this tradition of, you know, everybody fled the city in the summer with no air conditioning. They all went off and a lot of things closed. And the British don't have that. You know, they just stay in London. And so the numbers just, you know, are astounding. You look at shows that nobody heard of, like the Geisha Girl or Cheech and Chin, and it was like, oh my God, they ran over 1,000 performances. And it's only 1913, you know? So it's different.
Which show on the list, and there's a bunch of titles on here. It's so fascinating. Which one on this list was the hardest for you to find information about?
I did include reviews as well.
Yeah.
I would say they gave me trouble because Gansel does not consider a review musical theater.
Oh.
Very funny. If you look in that wonderful thick book of his, you will not find Ain't Misbehavin'. You will not find The Little Show. Yeah. You will not find The Bandwagon. He does not believe that reviews are theater, musical theater. So whenever I found like a Noel Coward review or an Andre Charlotte review, I had trouble. Because he wasn't there to help me.
Yes.
And I had to go to other sources. And so I would say those were the most troublesome. But they were popular, and I want to include them.
Sure.
And Andre Charlotte comes over with, you know, comes off the boat with Beatrice Lilly and, I forget who else was in that one. And then they singing 5 hits by Noel Coward. This is an important show.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's ignored by Gansel, but luckily there were enough reviews. And,
get it together, Kurt.
And I love how you.
Oh. It would be the hardest.
And at the end, I love that you have a guide of all the recordings. So if you're dying to hear the Lily of Kearney or something, you can figure out, you know, where you can, you know, listen to these. And I think that's a wonderful resource as well.
If they're not originals, somebody's recorded them in a studio. Some of these British old British ones. And then they've reissued them on CD. You know, it's great that you think, okay, who cares about the 1904 or so-and-so, you know? Right. Somebody must because they reissue it, you know? Gilbert and Sullivan, you can understand, you know,
because
it's such a huge following. Right. But when I see that the Arcadians has been re-released on CD, I go, whoa, you know? I mean, you know.
2007, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, they just recently came out with
amazing.
Arcadian. So so that's the inspiration for the book, and that was the hardest part. But the best part was to read about dozens and dozens of shows that were only titles to me. I'd only heard the titles, and to read these plots, some of them outrageously ridiculous, some of them like, hey, that sounds like that would work. British love fantasy. And so you have fantasy in big hits like Floridora and other ones. And you have fantasy in, I have to mention, one of their biggest hits that flopped here, and that's in Salad Days.
Yeah.
Mm. Any musical built around a magical piano that forces people to dance when it's played is a fantasy in my book. It also has a flying saucer in it. It's a delightful score.
Yeah.
Not only did this run 2000, it's been revived many times. It is still a favorite, and some of the songs are still done. What's wrong with these people, or in their version, what is wrong with Americans? What don't you like about Salad Days, you know?
I'm going to listen to that today.
Oh, I just wrote it down. Again.
Yeah, delightful score. But I would say that is the biggest example of what works there doesn't necessarily work here.
Yeah.
And that's been shown many times over the decades.
Yes. And on this wonderful list of shows that you've compiled in this book, let's imagine you have a time machine. You can go back and you can go see one of the performances of these shows, but you only get to see one. Which show would you want to go back and see?
I would love to see some of the original Gilbert and Sullivans.
Mm-hmm. Oh!
They were unbelievably good productions, you know. I mean, we know they hold up well, and now when they made that great movie called Topsy Turvy about the making of the Mikado, that was a British director, Mike Lee, he researched and made sure that every set, costume, everything was exactly like the original, because they have it all, you know, they got great museums and whatnot. And watching that made me think, wow, what it would have been like to see the first HMS Pinafore or the first Pirates of Penzance. So those are the first ones that could come into my mind. I would have liked to have seen Me and My Girl, huge success. Took 50 years to get here. But with Lupino Lane and the great comic Song and Dance Man, and to see how wonderful that show must have been, and why we had to wait, you know, 50 years before we saw how wonderful it was. I would have liked to have seen that original one. Yeah. I would have liked to have seen any of the Noel Coward ones with the reviews with Beatrice Lilly, you know.
Sure.
People, you know, they were on stage where, you know, movies didn't do justice to them. Those sort of things. There's a couple as I'm going, oh wow, this I would like to have seen.
Love that. And then how long did the book take you to create, from idea all the way up until May when it was published?
I would say almost every book, there's a few exceptions, are a year.
Yeah.
I figure a whole year.
And is that, and when you're doing that, is that the only book you're focusing on, or do you have other things going at the same time?
It's usually the only one.
Good for you. Now, so once again, listeners, it's an incredible book. Obviously, we're going to post a link, The Mikado to Matilda. And it's just like all of Thomas's books, you need them on your shelf. They're absolutely amazing. They're an incredible resource. Can you give us a little hint of what you're going to be working on next, or what the next book might be?
Well, it took so long for this book to come out. From when I finished it, I think some of it was affected by the virus.
Yeah.
Lucky enough to get it out. There are many books right now that are sitting in publishers' offices that are stuck in the process. It's really sad.
Yeah.
I have heard of, there's a book about Sondheim that I hear is really very good, and it is stalled. It's and I don't know the author, but it is stuck. It's not moving anywhere. It's a Sondheim encyclopedia, and sounds great, but it literally is like between steps and nothing's happening because of, you have to remember, these publishers, they let most of their staff go. They just said, go home, and they only kept the order department open so they could sell books. And so it delayed this book, and Mark Robinson and I started another book, and it was delayed that we decided to self-publish. And so the next book we're working on is a collaboration. I don't know if I'm allowed to say it this way, but we love Ken Mandelbaum's Not Since Carrie, and it has never been followed up. So our next book is 30 years of Broadway. We don't call them flops, but misfires. So from 1989 right up to the virus closing the theaters, we look at all the musicals that did not make money. We don't call them bombs. We don't call them flops, because some of them are outstanding, but they didn't make money. And the publisher, Rauman and Littlefield, the proposal sat there for 3 months. And so we just, you know, we were working on it. And nobody was answering, you know, so we said, this book won't come out until 2024 or something. And we wanted it now because the last chapter is about the virus.
Yeah.
And the idea that there are many reasons why shows do not make money. And now we've come up with a new reason that is scary, that a show that is so successful and has got great reviews and is doing boffo box office is stopped cold. And what is going to happen to that show? Is it going to come back? Is it going to throw the towel in? Is it going to, you know, go to television? So that's our last chapter, is looking at things. So we didn't want to wait for Robin and Littlefield to come back in the business.
Yeah.
So we're publishing it, and it's actually going to come out in September.
Oh, that's great news. We've been looking for something like that for so long. Yeah. I think you're going to get so many.
Oh, yes.
I've been talking about this, an update. So what a great idea.
Yeah. We look at them all, about 150 musicals over the last 30 years.
Yeah. This is serendipity, but I was actually emailing Mark this morning, and he said that it's going to come out in September. And obviously when it comes out, we'd love to have you guys both back on the show to promote it and discuss it. But we're so happy that's the next thing for you.
We just couldn't figure out why Ken Mandelbaum never did it. And it's been many years. It's been 30 years since that book came out, and he's never pursued it. And we didn't want to step on toes or anything, but we got word that he had no interest in writing a sequel. And so we always wanted a sequel, and we knew other people wanted to.
Right, everything.
We all do. Yeah.
So it was like, let's do it. And I think it was actually it was pushed by Robbie Roselle. He kept pushing Mark to do it. You got to do this book. Mark knows some periods better than I do. He knows some of the more recent stuff. He's, you know, between the two of us, it's all entries, you know, so we, like, who can handle this show better, you know?
Yeah.
And we do include the jukebox musicals. We don't include reviews, but we do include all the jukebox musicals. We include the horror musicals. We include right up to Tootsie, Be More Chill. I think the last most recent book, musical is The Lightning Thief, which played right before Christmas.
Oh, yeah. I saw that. Yeah.
That actually closed and lost money. And then it stopped, you know. And the big question mark, and we want the book to come out before it's, you know, before that the questions are answered, you know. What's going to happen to these shows that were running so well? Some have already announced that they're not going to reopen, but and we refuse to call them flops because we said that just is not true anymore. How do you take a show, you know, like, Sunset Boulevard, which ran 2.5 years and won Ivy Award in the book and never made a penny? Is that really a flop? You know? Spider-Man, you know, cost so much, it was a flop. But you take all these beautiful shows like Parade or Grey Gardens, or, you know, they didn't make any money, but everything about them is wonderful. Ken Mandelbaum put those kind of shows in his last chapter. You know, he had one chapter for the good shows that should have run. Well, it's not true anymore. A lot of good shows don't run. So we divided it by categories of based on movies, based on children's family things,
sure,
musical, you know, so, and it was heartbreaking to go back and visit these shows that just had everything going for them, but something was wrong, you know. Could have been the critics. Sometimes it was the audiences. Sometimes it was the timing. Sometimes it was, and sometimes they really were flops. I mean, they did everything wrong, you know?
Yeah, yes.
And let's face it, people have such warm spots for those musicals that they loved but weren't hits.
Yeah, we all do, yeah.
Some of our fondest memories.
We love talking about them. We love sharing them. We love finding each other's out. It's so true, yeah.
And we have one chapter just for the ones that, they flopped on Broadway, but my God, are they famous now. Mm. All Shook Up. All Shook Up is done more. Shrek didn't make a penny on Broadway.
Right.
Shrek was the top produced high school musical.
Yeah. Adam's Family,
years ago. Yeah. Look how many people do Parade.
Oh,
yeah.
It's beloved. The score is beloved.
How many people are doing Bridges of Madison County? These are all New York considered failures. Mm-hmm. But, and Seussical? Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God.
Oh, everywhere. Yeah, right?
Yeah. So, you know, it's almost to the point where Broadway success is just, you know, that's a relative term. you know. It was a hit on Broadway. There's shows that are hits on Broadway that nobody wants to touch, you know. They were successes of certain kinds. So it was a fascinating work to work on that book.
That is great, and we cannot wait to read it. We've loved every other book that you've ever done, and we thank you so much for producing an incredible legacy, but so many just wonderful resources for all of us geeks and academics out there. So thank you for that. Thomas, this has been an absolute pleasure. Once again, folks, the book is called The Mikado to Matilda, British Musicals on the New York Stage. It's available on Amazon, and we will obviously provide a link for you so you can go purchase it and enjoy your copy as well. Thomas, thank you so much for everything.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Till next time, everyone.
Thank you for listening to today's episode, and a big thanks to the punchy players Jeff Marquis, who is bringing back Lucy, Betty, Judy, and more to shill for us.
And a big thanks to our sound editor Daniel Schwartzberg and social media manager Bethany Ann Selecki.
And don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you come in.
In order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us just 1 star and you can make us feel as bad as Annie did in that really weird production in Boston where Annie dreamt that she was being adopted, but then she ended up back where in the orphanage, right back where she started. Yeah, true story. Rob saw it.
Yes, and it was Betty. It was bizarre. I was there. I was.
Oh, God.
So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.